How do you do? Jen and Cam feel it would be unkind to present this program without a friendly word of warning. We are about to unfold our true crime podcast, a podcast of lifelong friends who seek to examine crimes which were committed without reckoning upon God. The discussion will be frank, and the subject matter will be of a grim and violent nature. I think it will thrill you. It might even horrify you. So, if there are young children listening, or if you feel unwilling to subject your nerves to such a strain, now is your chance to... Well, we've warned you.
Hey, Jen, what up?
Hey, Camille, what's going on?
So much. I mean, there's just so much going on. I don't even know where to start.
So busy.
Just running around all the time. And, you know, my house is immaculately clean.
Always. And, but anyway, my house is so clean, there's no chance you could ever get cholera from it.
Well, yeah. I just, you know, the problem is once you have multiple days to do stuff, then you put it off, right? And so now I don't have to be anywhere till like August 10th. So yeah,
I'm trying to do
a little project each and every day. So yesterday's big project, well, it was twofold. Yesterday's big project was clean out the garage and write a script. And I did both. Now today, thanks. Today's big project, nothing yet. And it's 1 o'clock, 1:10, whatever.
Well, your project is this, right?
Kind of. Yeah. Yeah. But it's okay. So you ready to get started?
Yeah, let's go.
This is a head scratcher. Always is, right?
Mm-hmm.
Here we go. So 56-year-old Thomas Jones was a reserved kind of fella. You know, he lived modestly, kind of wanted a simple life. So the community of Melford, Delaware provided exactly what he wanted and needed. Thomas lived by himself and he was a farmer. He owned and operated a small farm, but he wasn't quite your typical farmer. Thomas was a paraplegic, but that didn't stop him from doing exactly what he loved to do, which was farming his land. He just modified the farm tools, such as tractors, to make it easier for him to get on. So he'd make like little contraptions that he could sit in and take him up and put him in the tractor, which I think is kind of cool, right? But he's
very
a farmer,
cool.
So of course he's used to doing stuff like that. Now, Thomas farmed the land, but really... You know, that might have been his livelihood, but his hobby was making investments. He liked to play the market. He was also an avid coin collector. He enjoyed the searching and then the finding of the rare coins to add to his coin collection, right? That was a big deal for him. And he took a lot of pride in that, okay? Thomas kept to himself a lot, and he really only relied on close family and a few friends, maybe a few neighbors. He did, however, need a bit of help, so a couple times a week, a healthcare worker would stop by his house, check in on him, make sure he's well, see if there's anything he needs.
Okay. That's nice to do.
It was August 13th, 1997, when a hired healthcare nurse stopped by to check on Thomas. The nurse arrived, she called out his name, and he didn't answer, so she went ahead and let herself in. She was looking around, and she knew something was just... not quite right. Thomas kept a very clean and tidy house. All things had their place. You know, he's a single guy. He's a bachelor, right? So as she's looking around, she's thinking, well, you know, he left dirty dishes on the table. That's not like him. So maybe he just, you know, went outside. So she goes outside and she's looking around. And then she saw it. She saw something and it was not good. There was a splattering of blood. Oh. On the ground.
Not good. That's correct.
Mm-hmm. And it looked like it was leading away as if being dragged or walking. Somebody that was injured, right? So the nurse rushes to the phone and she calls 911. Local police as well as state police race to the farmhouse. They worry that maybe he hurt himself or maybe got lost or confused on the farm somewhere. Searchers come through the fields in and around his house hoping to find him, unsure of what could have happened to him. So as the sun was setting... they're starting to get a little bit desperate. They have no answers. There was a helicopter that they had called in a little bit earlier, and, you know, the helicopter was going to make one more go around the area just to see if they could see anything. Mm-hmm. The helicopter noticed some fresh tire tracks that they had missed earlier. These tracks began at Thomas's house, went through the field, the farming field behind his house, and then across from that, beyond that, was a set of woods. And the tire tracks went through all of that. Like, he could see it leaving the house and going into the woods. Police are redirected to the area, and it was not long before a call comes in. They found the body of Thomas Jones on the ground. He had a sheet covering his body, and he had no clothes on. He was stripped naked. Ew. His wheelchair was nowhere to be found. He had been shot in the head. An officer reaches over and gets the shock of his life. Thomas gasped for air. Thomas was alive, but barely, and clinging to life. It now becomes clear he was left there to die. Although his condition was grave, he told officers he thought he had been out there for over 36 hours. Right? I mean, it's summer, like, but no clothes, no water, no food. And he's paralyzed, so it's not
with
like...
With a bullet hole in him.
In your head, thank you.
Yes. That's,
police?
I mean...
It's terrible.
Screw the not having clothes or just being in a sheet. He had a bullet hole in him for 36 hours before he was found.
Police then ask him, who did this to you? Thomas was able to mutter the name George Calamaris. He tells officers that George came to see him on the 13th and that they chatted for a little bit and then George left. Thomas then tells police that George returned later that day in the early evening, but he brought a weapon with him and shot Thomas in the back of the head. Police now know who did this, but they do not know why.
What a coward to shoot somebody from behind. Seriously.
Just wait. You're just going to roll over. I know you are because I did. George Calamaris, at this point, is age 42. He grew up in the suburbs of Washington, D.C. George's father was a police officer, but left that job to become a teacher, which I think is very admirable. While George was smart, he was also a bit lazy. You know the type. He flew from one job to the next. He was always looking for a fast buck without breaking a sweat. This cracked me up, so of course I had to write extra about it. So one of the unique ways that George first tried to make money, and you'll love this, because that's what I wrote, because I was going to tell you the story. Back in the days of early cable TV, homeowners needed a box to get cable TV. And you would pay extra money for the movie channels, the premium channels. Now, as people are apt to do, they want to get those free movie channels. So he saw a little thing here. And he went in and he created a device that would unscramble these movie channels. And he actually sold it to the community. He sold it to some local people. Now, of course, when the cable company figured this out, his business venture was short-lived because they would just go in and turn off the cable service altogether, right?
Mm-hmm. He's lucky he didn't get arrested because that is actual theft, stealing cable.
So it was about this time that George would meet the love of his life. Now, even though George was 16 years older than 22-year-old Nora Hagmeyer, George's father introduced the two of them because he knew that they would be a perfect match. And he was right. It was love at first sight. So when someone is like George, they have to be fast on their feet because they're
somebody's
trying to...
Somebody's lazy like George.
Yes. In fact, yeah. That's what I called the script because there's no other word for it. You know, you're trying to make a fast buck. You have a certain type of personality. Some call it charismatic and charming, while others would call it shady and shysty, right?
Con artist.
Yes. With Nora, it was the former. She really liked his charm. She liked his confidence and humor. And he was also, you know, older than her, so she kind of looked up to him, I think. The two would wed in October of 1994. With George not really having a job, the couple would live with Nora's parents. They actually lived sort of in the basement. It was like a little apartment that Nora's parents had made.
Home away from home, yeah.
Home away from home, but you're still home.
Mom,
and married.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Right? Nora was offered a job. It was a great job, actually, at Eastern Carolina University as a sign language interpreter. Nora's parents were both deaf, so she grew up signing and lip reading and all that stuff because that's how she communicated with her parents. But she also did that for a living. She went to school to do that. So she was thrilled when this opportunity came in that she would go and be a sign language interpreter for this university. The couple then moves to Greenville, North Carolina, to start a new life. Everything's great, right?
Mm-hmm.
As Nora is making a place for herself at the university, George is, well, being George, which basically means he's hanging out and pretending to do stuff. One of the things he did was meet a guy, a man by the name of Gary Thomas. Gary was a neighbor of George and Nora. They lived in an apartment complex down there, so it was like a neighboring building, but they're all in the same sort of little area. Gary and George became fast friends. Part of the reason is, well, because neither man really worked. George didn't want to work, and Gary, well, he had a hard time holding a job. Gary had come from a very wealthy, established family. In fact, they were the family. They created the Thomas Built Buses, which is a bus company, a school bus company, that supplies buses to schools across the United States. Pretty well-to-do, right? Gary, on the other hand, was pretty much the black sheep, as he struggled pretty much most of his life, most of his preteen, teen, and adult life. He struggled with drug addiction and alcohol addiction.
That's sad.
Gary's family had spent hundreds of thousands of dollars sending him to the best rehabs throughout the states. Unfortunately, Gary could never get clean and stay clean. A lot of times, these people that struggle with addiction really need to hit rock bottom, and they need to be shown a little bit of tough love. Such was the case with Gary, as his family decided to kick him out and force him to be on his own. Now, the only difference here, and I'm going to guess, is that if you're rich, tough love comes with a trust fund. Uh-huh. So it's really not tough love. It's more like comfortable because we don't want to deal with you love, right?
Uh-huh.
So Gary's now out on his own, but he does have a trust fund. He would be receiving a monthly payment from his trust fund every month. He didn't have to work.
That could probably go straight to drugs and alcohol.
They kind of shunned him, right? So he didn't really stay in contact with his family, but he would send them cards, occasional letters, things like that. Maybe talk to him on the phone, but not that often, right? Because he was kind of, like I said, he was very close with his grandfather, but otherwise that was it. Old Gary was a bit of a braggart. He liked to tell people that he came from a wealthy family and that he liked to tell people that he liked to spend money and he liked to spend a lot of money and he liked to tell them how he spent it. And as you just said earlier, yep, you guess it, hookers and blow and alcohol and any drug, really, because he'd just get what he could.
That's what they do, right?
Right. Unemployed George liked to hang out with Gary because Gary was always paying for everything. And he offered George a slice of the exciting life, right? Because George is married now. His wife's working all the time. He's not doing anything. So George is, you know, they'd get together, smoke a little weed, drink, whatever. As the friends grew closer, George would always ask Gary a lot of questions. But like I said earlier, Gary was always very happy to share his stories, as well as any information about his family. If George asked a question, Gary would answer him and not think it was strange. See where I'm going with this?
Mm-hmm, I do.
As the men continued to hang out, Nora was less than pleased about it. And honestly, she was really worried not only about George, but Gary. It had become clear that Gary had some major issues, and those issues were getting worse over time. George and Nora would step in and they tried to get Gary to go to rehab. And this time, Gary agreed. And after Gary told his family via a phone call that he was going to go in to rehab, he was really happy. He sounded happy. He said he was going to be successful this time, and they were thrilled. George and Nora would care for Gary's place when he's gone, and they'll take care of his mail, his bills, pay his rent, and all that stuff for him while he's gone. Keep everything as it is. Gary's not in rehab for too long before his family received a positive letter from Gary. Gary was saying that he was really trying this time. He was finding a lot of success because he knew that this was it. This was like his last shot. He had to make it successful. He had to get clean. He had to stay clean. So his family was very proud of him. But, you know, they'd been through this more than a couple times, right? In the fall of 1996, the officer in charge of Gary's trust fund received a letter from Gary. Gary informed the trust officer that he had, in fact, completed rehab. He was finally drug and alcohol free. And to celebrate this huge achievement, he wanted to go on vacation, and he's going to need some extra money to do this. Oh, and he also needed $10,000 for a new car.
Oh, yeah, that sounds good.
Mm-hmm. During this time, Gary's family continued to get letters and cards from Gary telling them how great he was doing. And, you know, he was actually doing something great. He was working in South America. He was building homes for the needy as well as churches, laying some water lines so that they could get fresh water and things like that, right?
Yeah.
You go, Gary.
That's promising.
Mm-hmm. While Gary was not around to hang out with George anymore, George and Nora decided to move back to Maryland. that's where they were born and raised, and they wanted to be closer to family since the couple just welcomed their first child. Since Gary was gone, George told the landlord that Gary had left and he would not be coming back and to go ahead and rent out the place. And George also decided to sell all of Gary's things and keep the money. Oh, and another thing. The bank received word from Gary. He's not in South Africa anymore, Jen. You know, he's back here in the good old United States because he's moving back, right, to the United States. To Maryland, near George.
Wow.
Right?
That's a coincidence, yeah.
Co-winky dink, right?
Mm-hmm. I'm having a feeling that something's not adding up here.
Something's not quite right. He tells the bank, hey, don't worry. You know what? As soon as I get there, get settled, I'm going to provide you with my home address for you guys to contact me if you need anything, as well as, you know, send me my money every month.
Right. But don't call the other stuff. Don't call the other numbers. Whatever you do.
Right.
Yeah.
You can make this up. He cray cray. Sadly, Gary's grandfather passes away in December of 1996. Now, this is the man who set up the trust fund for Gary. He was also the one that was pretty close to Gary. Gary thought a lot of him. He was out of the family. He's the one that Gary would kind of go to. And I see that. We all have those, you know, the child where you kind of, I don't know, as grandparents, you know, they kind of see the soft one or whatever. You know what I'm saying?
Yep.
So the family tries to reach out to Gary. And even though they don't hear back from him, they give him the details of the funeral service, as well as the bad news, obviously. And they're sure he'll attend or show up, or at least place a phone call since he and his grandfather were so close. Gary failed to show up for the funeral. He didn't even call. So now the family's thinking, maybe he's back on drugs. Like, maybe he's in the street or worse yet, dead from, you know, an OD or whatever. So the family keeps attempting to try to locate Gary, and they hire some people to try to find him. They can't find him, but they do find out that his payments are still being made and they're getting cashed. So the payments are still going to Gary and Gary is cashing them? Question mark.
Somebody is. Uh-huh.
Gary's nowhere to be found.
I'm shocked.
Shocked, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this takes us up to, this is where these two things are going to kind of tie together. Fast forward to August of 1997. George told Nora that he's going to drive to his family's property, which is about 2.5 hours away from where they live in Maryland, and it's in Delaware. While George is there, he's going to check in on one of his old neighbors, a man by the name of Thomas Jones. Now, it's been years since George had seen Thomas, but knowing that Thomas doesn't really socialize a lot, he figured he'd be home. Thomas invited George inside right away, and the two did some catching up. Thomas even showed George his beloved coin collection. And George asked Thomas, you know, a lot of questions about what's going on in his life. You know, the usual about the coins, his investments, if he had a lot of money coming in, how often. You know, the usual kind of questions you ask people that you
just
haven't seen for
cuff.
Years,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. So how you doing? How's that 401k? And what's the PIN number to get in there? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Just send that to me. So George left, but not for good. George would return later that day with a gun. He shot Thomas in the back of the head. Then he stole all the documents he could find pertaining to any and all of Thomas's investments, stock holdings, funds, and assets. Oh, and then he stole the coin collection. Doing all of this while poor Thomas was slumped over in his wheelchair at the dining table. After George got all he wanted, he wheeled Thomas out of the house, threw both Thomas and his wheelchair into the back of his truck. Obviously, he believed that Thomas was dead at this point. And thank God Thomas didn't let on that he wasn't. He then took Thomas to the woods behind the farmhouse where he would undress him. And in case, I guess, he did this because it never really said, but I'm sure he thought that maybe he left something behind, something of himself, like DNA or evidence or whatever. And he tossed Thomas into the field, but covered him up with the sheet. He's naked and they, you know, which I just find that weird. I don't like, he thinks he's dead. Right? So, and
right.
I don't know. People are so weird. George makes it home. Now, he thinks he's gotten away with the murder of Thomas Jones. For a few days, that is, until Thomas was found and tells police what happened. The news hits the airwaves, reminding people to be on the lookout for an armed and dangerous man. So, with that, George was tipped off. Police head over to his house, and they talk to Nora, his wife, who tells police that not only is George not home, he hasn't been home for days. She doesn't know where he is at this moment. She hasn't heard from him. Police search the house, and there's no sign of George. They do, however, find a few checks with a strange name on them. Gary Wayne Thomas. Now, police think that's just too weird. This has to be the same person. Thomas Jones has to be Gary Wayne Thomas. The names are too similar, right? Mm-hmm. So people go by different names, you know, sometimes, I guess. Like, you have a, you know, your real name, and then you go by nicknames, things like that, I guess. So back at the station, detectives start making some phone calls. They determine that Gary Wayne Thomas is not Thomas Jones. He is, in fact, a man from North Carolina, and his family has not seen him in well over a year. They also find out that Gary had a large trust fund, but the checks were now being sent to an address in Dickerson, Maryland, which happens to be about an hour away from George's house. FYI. Police wonder if Gary Thomas's disappearance is connected to Thomas Jones' attempted murder. Police go to the Maryland address Gary Thomas listed as his house. Remember, he provided an address to the bank about his new house in Dickerson, Maine, to get his check, his mail sent. When they arrive, they find a man who he's tinkering around in the garage, and they find out that he is the homeowner. And of course, they want to have a little chat with this guy because this is not Gary Thomas, right? So the man tells police that he and George were friends and that in the past they had built some racing engines together, some you know, earlier, like I said, George built that device to unscramble cable TV. So obviously he likes to build machines and things like that. And that's what this guy did. The two of them would get together and build some engines. So detectives ask the man, why is mail coming to your house that is addressed to Gary Thomas? The man tells them that he allowed George to have that mail forwarded to this address. And every few days, George would come by and get it. The guy never really asked George, what is that, right? Which I think is strange.
I don't know if I would.
You would?
They're if buddies.
Yeah, it's just kind of weird, though. Why isn't this going to your house, right? It's a little shady. Police then ask the man, when was the last time you either saw or talked to George? What the man said next literally sent chills down my spine. Full body chills, Jen.
Oh, not full body chills.
Yeah. He tells detectives that the last time he saw George, George had come over to ask for some help in breaking down some things he needed to get rid of, to toss away, but they were too big to throw away as they were. Could he help break them down? Because, you know, he had all the tools in his garage, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the man says, huh, okay, well, let's go take a look. And he walks out and he looks in the back of the truck. And he said, you want me to break that down? You want to break down a wheelchair? Where'd you get that from? George remarks, you don't want to know. Mm-hmm. So the man had a creepy feeling right away. And he's like, yeah, I don't feel comfortable with that. And that's going to be a hard nope. I'm not doing that, right? I mean, who breaks down a wheelchair? It is now starting to become clear to police that George needs to be found and found fast, and he has more than a few questions to answer. Police reach out again to Nora. They're pleading for information about George and his whereabouts. Again, Nora claims she has not seen him. She hasn't heard from him. You know, I don't know. I can't help you. Police are like, okay, okay, thank you. And then they put a surveillance team on her because come on now. So they start following Nora around with the hopes of finding George, that maybe she would lead them to George. Now, they know that Nora knows more than she's saying, you know? And finally, days of tracking her around, they get sick of it. And they're just like, forget this. They go confront her. And they tell her, listen, here's the deal. George is in a lot of trouble. He's going down. He's going to go down for attempted murder. They don't mention the Gary Thomas connection yet. And, you know, you're going to go right there with them. You need to start talking. Well, she panics and she agrees to help police arrest George. She tells police that she has set up a meeting with Gary and they're going to meet on August 20th, 1997. And she's giving him money, food, clothes, anything that he can need because he's going to make an escape. He's going to leave the area. She tells police all this with the idea, you know, I guess it's a little sting operation. She's helping get the police to him. She's going to lead them. Going to lead George to the police or the police to George. Okay?
Right. Mm-hmm.
Nora arrives at the scene. Police move in and arrest George without incident. He's screaming, he's yelling. I'm sure he was not too happy. At this point in time, George is told he's being arrested for the attempted murder of Thomas Jones only. George is placed in the Montgomery County Detention Center, and he is none too happy about it. He's not happy about Nora ratting him out. He's not happy he got caught. So he's just sitting in there. He's just brewing. He's steaming, right? He comes up with this plan. Oh, George. He comes up with this plan, and he decides, you know, if I can just get rid of Thomas Jones, because I didn't do it the first time, this whole situation, it's going to go away. If I can get rid of him, like, right, then I can't be charged with trying to kill him, because somebody else obviously did it, right?
Oh, yeah. Let's make things worse.
Thank you. George befriends a man by the name of Norman Ellis and asks Ellis for a favor. Hey, buddy. Hey, I
big favor.
Yeah, you know, I need a little favor.
Hey,
for you.
I just met you, and this is crazy. But could you kill a man?
Yeah. So of course, you know that favor is, hey, I need a hitman. Can you help me find one? Now you can about count the minutes it takes for Norman Ellis to be like, oh yeah, sure, I'll help you, George. And he hightails it out of there to go tell detectives because he's hoping he can get out jail free or earlier card by providing this information that George is trying to do this, right? Detectives are like, heck yeah. But, you know, we're going to play your little game. We're going to recommend you get an early release, but you're going to have to help us nail George. Ellis is all in. Count me on board. So Norman Ellis comes back to prison. A couple days goes by. Tells George, hey, I got good news. And that news is that I have found a hitman for you, George. But he needs some money as well as some more information. George is like, I already got you. I got it taken care of. So Norman Ellis tells George that it's going to cost him a cool $10,000 for a hitman, which I think is kind of expensive because usually when you hire a hitman and they're on 60 Minutes and stuff, it's like $2,000, right? $2,000.
Well, I guess if it's a bad hitman, they might not charge a lot.
Or they go to police, so you'd be like, heck yeah.
Exactly.
George not only is, okay, no problem, I can provide that $10,000. He says, hey, look, I've already done this for you. Here's a map of the location that you need to go. Here's another map of the outline of the house. Okay, you need to get in there. This is where he's going to be. He's a paraplegic. All this stuff, right? I mean, it was like, police were hoping that they would just do the money. They didn't even really think about the map and all that. So this guy, I mean, what a dummy, right? So Ellis says, and this is per the police, I'm going to give you this address for my hitman, and you're going to have to make sure you send money. It's a P.O. box. You're going to, you know, put the money in there. As soon as he gets the money, consider the hit done within, you know, the next couple days. Well, the P.O. box obviously had been rented by police, and they just get to sit there and watch and see who's going to, as soon as the money's dropped in there, they know it's from George. Bam, they got him, right? So George is all set for this. So he's going to arrange to have the payment sent with the note, and the note would say that, yeah, after the hit was complete, they would get the rest of the money. Now, George, as you can tell, he ain't real bright, right? So
right.
Police sit back and they're going to watch this P.O. box. They're watching. They're waiting. George is in jail as, you know, this post office. The next thing is to see who's going to deliver the money, right? Because obviously George can't. So they need to know who else is in on this game. So it's not long before the money's delivered to the P.O. box. And guess who is not very bright as well as George? You want to take a guess?
There's so many characters in here that I can say who it is, but
that's
I'm going
right.
to let you tell us. Mm-hmm.
That is right, Jen. It's Nora, his wife. Mm-hmm. She delivers the hitman down payment to the post office. Surprised, but not totally shocked, police now wonder just how much involvement has Nora had in all of this. She's obviously in on the hiring of the hitman plan, right? Is she mm-hmm. also, was she in on the Gary disappearance? All that stuff.
Right.
Police decide they're just going to wait and watch, right? Just monitor mm-hmm. things for a little bit. And they begin to watch Nora as well as, you know, kind of look at what kind of mail is coming into George and what kind of mail is going out from George. Police contact Gary Thomas's family and they tell them what's going on and what they think is going on. And they ask that they leave Gary's trust fund account open, as they want to try to figure out who is taking the money out of his trust. Who's doing it? Like, George is in prison now, right? The withdrawals are coming out of an ATM in Maryland by none other than Nora.
Wow.
Nora was withdrawing money to pay all her bills. You can't make
Naughty
this up.
Naughty Nora.
Right? Yeah. And this mm-hmm. is the worst part. You ready?
Yeah.
She even took $500 out of Gary's account to pay for the hitman. Right? Who does that? So, and she has a job. Like, and they... Police can now tie the disappearance of Gary Thomas to not only George, but Nora as well. On September 13th, right? That's why I said this. These cases are crazy. This is, I fall down and I'm like, what? And then I keep going. And I'm like, what?
Could you imagine what these people could do if they were actually smart?
Or like put all that, he's got a mechanical mind, obviously, right? Doing all this and the work that it would take to do all that.
No, if they just thought things through and were just a bit
better
more
criminal, better criminal.
Yeah, just more thoughtful in their actions when they do this,
All right, here we go. On September 13th, 1998, something happened that's really tragic, but it's also going to bring a bit of sick justice for George. Thomas Jones passes away due to the injuries he sustained from George that August night. This turns an attempted murder case into first-degree murder.
Sucks to be him.
Nora is also arrested and charged with bank fraud, conspiracy to commit bank fraud, and money laundering. George is distraught over the fact that Nora will go to prison, and she's going to do time there for all that, right? This was not a small thing. And he's freaking out. So he goes to police and he says, listen, I can't have this. I will cut a deal with you as long as you don't give her prison time so that she can raise our child. Little odd, I think, but okay, right?
I agree. Mm-hmm.
Please think about it. They agree as long as he fully cooperates. He also will not face the death penalty in exchange for any and all information pertaining to Gary Wayne Thomas and Thomas Jones. He's a pretty lucky fella, right?
Very lucky fella.
So now we get to hear what happened. George tells authorities all about Gary. When George found out that Gary had money, the seed was planted in George's head. But he couldn't kill Gary right away and assume his identity, which was his plan to get the money. But he needed to take a little time to get to know Gary, to get to know his family, to get to know vital information, to make the assumption of his identity that much more realistic, right? George slowly starts getting information from Gary. Big things like how much he got from his monthly trust payments to smaller things such as his mom's birthday. George created a document on his computer, like an Excel sheet, to keep track of all this information he was slowly squeezing out of Gary. All said and done, George would take well over $10,000 from the trust fund, definitely. I mean, that's what they could trail. That doesn't, he got more. More. He was going to pay the hitman $10,000.
Jesus.
I mean, this is sick, right? George was gathering the information and he was just going to wait till the time was right. That time came one weekend in July when Nora was out of town. George and Gary hanging out, drinking, smoking some weed, doing what they do. And George asked Gary if he wants to go look at his weed plants, his marijuana plants. Now, George had a little garden in the back, of course, of some marijuana plants. And they had done it before when they were hanging out. Gary would go look at them and they'd talk and just hang out. It's outside. The two men go and they go to the area. It's not too far from where they live. As the two men are walking, it's dark out. They both have flashlights. George allowed Gary to walk in front of him. They were walking side by side. He slowly allowed Gary to get in front of him. George then reached into his pocket, took out a gun, and shot Gary in the back of the head. Right there and then. George removed all of Gary's clothing and his ID. George was hoping that since it was in July, and this is like smack dab July, right? The weather, it's going to be hot, it's going to be humid, it's going to be rainy. He did all this on purpose and was hoping that Gary's body would decompose faster and they wouldn't be able to identify who he was, right? Several weeks pass and George decides he needs to go back and he needs to see where we are with the body decomposing. Can you believe this guy? He goes back and it's pretty well decomposed, but to make sure, he's going to take some bones, such as a skull and some, go back and identify this person as Gary.
Right.
He took the bones, put them in a bag, and he went back to the house. He then knocked out all of the teeth in the skull, Gary's teeth, and smashed them to bits, then smashed his skull. So there would be no identifying thing. How sick is that, right? Yeah. I mean, the whole thing's sick. George then went to Gary's apartment and made it look like Gary was still alive. He was sending his parents birthday cards, Christmas cards. He was keeping up the facade that Gary was still living. That's why he needed the information with his mother's birthday and all that stuff.
Right.
George would stand trial, and he was sentenced to 395 years in prison with no parole, right? Nora would serve 6 months of house arrest. George would die in 2015 in prison after he suffered a heart attack.
So that's something, man. I'm telling you.
And that's the story of Lazy George.
That's a lot of work, though. You know, instead of just
getting a job. That's what I'm saying. Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, that's it. So.
Good one. Nice surprise. Kind of surprise. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So do you? We got any promos this week? Anything going on?
Our promo this week is for Sublime True Crime. It's our new friends. They haven't been podcasting for very long. I believe they're on episode 16 as of this week. But Dan and Elaine, they are a couple in northwest of England, I should say. Hmm. And they started a UK-based true crime podcast.
Oh, cool.
Hi, Elaine. And I think they're kind of like us. I think they're serious, but not so serious.
Nobody has as many technical issues as we do. Let's be honest. See right there.
Anything. Yeah. Good right. times.
What else? Anything else, Jen? Anything you need to tell the people?
That I love them. No. I hope you're doing better. I hope everybody's doing well, I should say. I know this thing that's going on has got me horribly down, but trudging through it and trying to make the best of it. And I hope you guys are too. So,
yes.
There you
go. I concur.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody, hang tight out there. And until that time, remember, lock your doors
and keep passing by those open windows.
Bye bye.
Love you.
Today's episode was researched and written by me, Cam. For more information about this episode, as well as all the sources I used, please check out our show notes or the podcast website at ourtruecrimepodcast.com. Our True Crime Podcast is developed and created by hosts Jen and Cam. Original music and audio mix of all our True Crime Podcast episodes is courtesy of Nico Vertese from We Talk of Dreams. Listener discretion is provided by Edward October from October Pod VHS. Our True Crime Podcast is executive produced by Nico Vertese and Dick Bain. Make sure to like and subscribe to Our True Crime Podcast wherever you listen to your podcast. We can be reached on Instagram and Facebook at Our True Crime Podcast or on Twitter at Our True Crime Pod. You can email us at ourtruecrimepodcast@gmail.com. If you really like the show, make sure to check out our Patreon at Our True Crime Podcast. Our True Crime Podcast is an OTC production.
I'm Dan.
I'm Elaine.
And we host the Sublime True Crime Podcast, with a new episode every Sunday. We're possibly the only podcast where one of the co-hosts can't pronounce the name of their own show.
Oh, but you do try.
Yes, I wonder who that could be.
We concentrate on UK crimes of all kinds. Murder, rape, serial killers. We've even covered the world's largest mugging recently. Although my favourite is still the Hatton Garden heist.
That was a really good episode. I really enjoyed that one. Mm-hmm. All of the crimes we cover are solved cases, barring the first episode where, in fairness, we were finding our feet.
Is that the one where you didn't realise it was unsolved until you'd written most of the episode and then didn't want to waste it?
Maybe.
We are currently completely ad-free, and we've just finished our first season. We'd love for you to come and listen to us.
Just search for Sublime True Crime on any good podcast provider, click subscribe, and listen to the back catalogue of 15 existing episodes.
We hope you'll join us soon. Until then, goodbye.
Goodbye.
Yeah.
There is no chance you could ever get... Oops, sorry.
What?
Sorry.
What is that?
I picked up my phone and a video of David Tennant went off.
Oh, okay.
Because I was watching it.
Thomas was a paraplegic. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm listening.
Oh, I thought you would say like, oh, wow. Okay, gotcha. Because, okay, sorry.
Let me a paraplegic farmer. What was the farm? What did he farm?
I'm not even sure. You with me still?
I am. Okay. I'm just listening to you scroll.
I know, sorry.
Scrolling. Keep that script going.
That's pretty good.
I get stuff from you, or for you. Most of it's junk mail, but... I mean, I got something to you from Jake at State Farm.
Nuh-uh. Really?
Yeah.
Did you really?
Yeah. I get junk mail for you all the time.
How? We never even lived together.
I don't know. Did you have something sent to me once before so nobody would know that you bought something?
Probably.
You know? So.
New shoes, coat. Yeah, probably. Yeah, you're right. You know. Okay. That's weird, though. Ooh, I don't like that. Mm-hmm. Okay, back to the story. Sorry.
I'm sorry. My niece just sent me a picture. Mm-hmm. Earlier, she sent me a picture earlier. A baby raccoon fell through their chimney.
Mm-mm.
Like, he's tiny. And she sent me a video, and he's just, like, chirping. And they put him on a box on their roof, hoping that the mom will come back, you know, because he's chirping. Well, looks like they went and look in the chimney. They are living inside the chimney. And she just sent me a picture. She took a picture with the flash up there, and she looks, and there's like a little raccoon poking her head down.
How do they live? Back is there up like there. A crate? I mean,
Netting
or something?
I have no idea. There's like the trap door that opens and shuts, whatever. It's not trap door, but you know what I mean?
Yeah.
The flue?
Yeah. Yeah.
Or whatever. But I don't know how they're... living, but it's the cutest damn little picture I've seen. She's so excited. She's like, they're living in our chimney.
Good thing it wasn't winter and they did a fire in there. That'd be terrible.
Yeah. She's like, hopefully she comes out soon. The baby's right outside the chimney. Okay. So cute. I'm sorry. I just...
No. That's cute. She should adopt a little baby. Remember Bella?
I told her.
The neighbors had the raccoon. Sorry. Sorry,
Nico.